Marsha here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Quick note before we get started, this show is part of our expanded coverage. It's possible because we've had, for the past month, so many listeners step up and subscribe and support the show via our Supercast subscription. So if you have not done so and you think that we're doing important work, want to contribute, help us build something better for media, for conversation, for all these different bits, I would love for you to go to realignment.supercast.com or click in the show notes in the description of this episode in your podcast player. You can give us $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. Doing that support right now as we're figuring out ads, we're figuring out what we're going to do going forward, helps us keep this content unpaywalled, which, you know, if you could afford it right now, is really huge because we've got really tough economic times going on. And there are just a lot of younger listeners who cannot be expected to subscribe to their 15th or 20th subscription. So once again, if you could go to realignment.supercast.com or follow a show link in the notes, really appreciate that as we continue to do these 3 to 4 episodes a week. Now, on to today's episode. We've got a really great one, speaking with Dr. Francis Fukuyama about his new book, Liberalism and Its Discontents. As Francis notes, this is not liberalism in the sense of the left or progressivism. It's liberalism in the sense of classical liberalism, these ideas around how many Western and even not just Western, but even societies such as Japan have been organized around since basically the Enlightenment in the 18th century. As he really talks about, there's this whole situation right now where there's deep dissatisfaction with this political situation across the globe. And he really ties this down to the fact that liberalism in its forms is not moderated enough. It's attacked by the left. It's attacked by the right. If you listen to our episode of Saurabh Amari, that's a guest who specifically came on last month to talk about his deep critique of liberalism. So Francis is coming on with his moderated version that could answer those critiques once again from the left and the right. You've probably heard of Francis Fukuyama before because he's, of course, famous for his 1989 end of history idea that happened as the Berlin Wall fell. We're not going to get into that today. It's a whole other podcast. But basically, the idea was that with the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, we're getting into a world where history, defined as competition between different systems of government, between different ideas, would effectively be over. Now, obviously, as we're looking at the war in Ukraine, we're looking at these debates over neoliberalism and what best way we could probably organize ourselves. It's pretty clear there's a lot of debate going on. So if you want to learn more about Francis's work, I definitely suggest going into it because it's definitely something we'll cover on a future episode. Follow that. Bit of a long one, but really appreciate it. Hope you enjoy this episode. Francis Fukuyama, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's a million different places that we could start on a conversation like this, so I'm going to try to go in a very specific order. I want to start with the piece that's going to be most relevant to listeners right now. We're recording this episode on the 10th. This is the launch date for Liberalism and Its Discontents. Yesterday, obviously, was Russia's Victory Day parade. And obvious recognition of World War II, everything like that. What's just your current obvious analysis of the situation in Ukraine right now?
I think that Russia has lost the war. They started with this intention to overthrow the regime in Kyiv and to incorporate basically the whole of Ukraine into Russia. They're not going to come remotely close to doing that. They've already been humiliated in their attempt to capture the capital. They've withdrawn from that, and now they're trying to push in the Donbass. And, you know, my prediction is that they'll lose that battle as well, and the Ukrainians are likely to actually drive them out of all the territory that they occupied after February 24th. This really has a much larger significance than just for the country Ukraine, because, you know, this is something that I've believed really back since 2014, that Ukraine has become the frontline state in a global battle between democracy and authoritarianism. Putin back in 2019 gave an interview to the Financial Times where he said that liberalism is an obsolete doctrine and he has an alternative to liberalism. And I think he himself sees this in these kinds of ideological terms, that he doesn't like The kind of self-government and freedom that Western countries enjoy. And he wants to prove that his system is superior, that the United States in particular is in long-term terminal decline. And were he to have succeeded in his original plan, I think a lot of authoritarians around the world would have keyed off of that and, you know, made moves on their own. Now, they're stuck, being allied to somebody that looks like a pretty abject failure. And I think that's probably good for the reputation of liberal democracy around the world.
You just said a lot of interesting things, but the thing I'm most interested in is how certain you are. You said the phrase, I predict. I do a lot of these interviews, and the recurring feature when one speaks to someone such as yourself is, I don't like to make predictions. I don't want to make a clear statement. Well, I'm just curious, as an intellectual, how do you get over that urge not to make predictions when everything's being recorded? And there is this image, obviously, of someone replaying this someday if you're wrong.
Well, I usually make all those caveats that you just alluded to. But, you know, in the case of Ukraine, I follow especially the military side of the conflict very carefully. A lot of people may not know this about me, but I began my career at the RAND Corporation, which was a think tank that was established originally by the U.S. Air Force. But we did a lot of work for the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the U.S. Army and so forth. And back in the 1980s, the subject that I looked at was the Soviet military. Mm-hmm. And so I have some background in analyzing military affairs. And it struck me that, and it's also relevant to my political knowledge, because I've been going to Ukraine regularly for the last 7-8 years. I know lots of Ukrainians because I've been directing a bunch of training programs for mid-career Ukrainian leadership programs. And I understand very well how committed they are to making Ukraine into a modern, uncorrupt democracy. And conversely, it seems to me that many of the problems that Russia is experiencing are directly related to its form of government. You know, it's led by a guy that looks like a kind of crazed lunatic right now, who sits at these, 20-foot long tables because he doesn't want to get infected by his defense minister. And, that kind of authoritarian decision making, where you don't have checks and balances, you don't have to bounce your ideas off of other people, and you don't really have to be informed about what's going on in the rest of the world, I think is really at the core of this colossal mistake that Putin made by attacking Ukraine. He thought Ukraine would collapse quickly because Ukrainians actually believed that they were really Russians and somehow they're being held in bondage by the West. He didn't understand that they developed a very separate national identity, that they're proud to be Ukrainians. They didn't want to be Russians. But I think you can make a mistake, and don't get me wrong. I mean, the United States has made plenty of big foreign policy mistakes in recent years, unfortunately. But I do think that there's something that comes directly out of the nature of the regime that explains the magnitude of this particular mistake. And I just see that, the differences in morale ultimately are going to have a really big impact on the outcome of the war. And that's why I've felt, reasonably confident in predicting that the Ukrainians will succeed. One final thing to say is, I have a lot of conversations with friends in Ukraine, and they never say if we win. They're talking about when we win, we're going to do X, Y, and Z to rebuild our country. It I think reflects a general self-confidence that they've got. I think we ought to share that as well.
I'm glad you brought up the systemic structural weaknesses in that system, because it gets to the broader topic here of liberalism. And it's the title, I say the title, and it's discontents here, because as someone who interviews people and has these conversations, there's been this interesting shift over the past few months. I think your essay a few months ago probably, I think, was the start of the shift, where for the past 5 years, liberalism has just really been, let's just say, getting kicked around rhetorically. So Patrick Deneen writes, why liberalism failed and President Obama selects it as one of his top books of the year. We just had Sohrab Ahmari on the podcast. He's obviously said, I'm very anti-liberal, yet we're seeing in this case of this war, and then the domestic China example, which I'd love you to get into because you wrote a piece about this too, the weaknesses of these systems, which are very anti-liberal in their own senses. So could you speak about how what's happened with the COVID lockdowns in China, Shanghai, et cetera, that has exposed the dangers of that system domestically too?
Sure. Well, first of all, we got to do some definitional work here because the way I use liberalism is not the way it's typically understood in American politics, which basically means, you know, left-wing progressive politics. I actually think that a lot of progressives in the United States have become illiberal in terms of freedom of speech and due process and a lot of other liberal principles. I'm not using it in a European sense where it's taken to mean a kind of pro-free market center-right position. And I certainly don't identify it with libertarianism, which basically is opposed to the state, you know, as such. In my view, liberalism is really about constraints on government. It believes in the kind of universal moral equality of all human beings, and that we've got a rule of law, checks and balances, these institutions that protect individuals from overreach by governments. And if you have that kind of a system in place, you know, I consider you liberal. It's not connected to a particular economic policy. So in that sense, I think social democratic Sweden and Denmark are liberal societies because they protect those fundamental rights. Whereas, you know, and even a country like Singapore can qualify as liberal, even though they don't have free and fair regular elections, because they do have a pretty strong rule of law. So that's the sense in which I mean liberal. And if you think about liberalism as constraining government power, you see that it has a lot of implications, you know, for, among other things, foreign policy, but also domestic issues like the control of COVID. As far as I can see, China has been engaged in what I think is a ridiculous zero COVID policy. That may have been worthwhile early on in the pandemic, but at this point, you know, when we're now dealing with an Omicron strain that doesn't get people all that sick, it makes no sense to lock down, you know, one of your major cities with, I don't know, 27 million people, which is Shanghai, simply in order to be able to boast that you don't have cases of COVID. And they're not succeeding in, you know, doing any of that. But the problem with that policy stems from the fact that it's really decided by one man, by Xi Jinping. China used to be in the period from 1978 to 2013 when Xi took over, you know, an authoritarian regime, but one that was pretty well institutionalized. They had a system of collective leadership where all the senior leaders had to get together and talk over things and, you know, make decisions that they all agreed with. Whereas now you've got this personalistic dictatorship. And I think Xi is so much invested in zero COVID that, you know, nobody dares to talk him out of the policy. And that's the reason that, you know, people in Shanghai and other parts of China are suffering the way they do. So this all brings us back to why you need liberalism. You know, you need constraints on executive power. And, you know, there are lots of ways of constraining it. I think the most effective way is to have a real rule of law with an independent judiciary that has a lot of moral power to, you know, prevent rulers from doing whatever they want. And that's really one of the fundamental fights now that's going on in the world.
So you just gave, I think, a helpful definition of liberalism. I think most listeners, left, right, and center, hearing what you just said, are going to say, okay, who are the people with discontents then? Because that sounds pretty great. Who are the critics of the liberalism that you're of the liberalism you're describing?
Sure. Well, I think they exist on both the right and the left. So if we begin with the people on the left, because liberalism constrains power, it tends to be slow. It tends to be procedural. Liberals create a lot of rules because it is based on a rule of law. And, you know, there's this tendency of law and rules to kind of expand willy-nilly over time. And I think that, progressives that are interested in social justice objectives get very frustrated. I was just in a discussion with some of my students and they said, look, you know, we have the financial crisis and all these, problems that were created by excessively concentrated wealth in the United States. And here it is, years later, nothing's happened. You know, the same people are in charge. You have the same power structure. And, you know, our liberal politics isn't sufficient to really get to the kind of more radical policies that we think are necessary to cure this problem. So that's, that's one strand of criticism from the left. On the right, I think
quick interruption. Yeah. Okay. I'm curious about this. When you think of left critics of illiberalism, oftentimes these critics of liberalism, these critiques will also apply to, let's say, corporations or private actors. Is your framework of liberalism purely based on state power, or can there be private institutions that can act in that way?
Oh, sure. So I think that the state is the most powerful and therefore the most dangerous potential violator of people's rights. But I think that large corporations and monopolies also pose a danger. And I think that's, really the problem now and with these big internet platforms that are really responsible for being the curators of political speech in, in the United States. I don't trust the government to curate that discourse, but I also don't particularly trust these large platforms either. To take the best interest of, democracy into account rather than their own bottom lines or simply responding to the kinds of political pressures that they're put under. So, yes, I do think that freedom can be challenged, not just by the state, but by, other actors in society.
So you're getting to the right then?
Well, we had a Stanford working group on platform scale where, we argued that the problem with the large platforms is their size and their ability to amplify particular voices and to silence, other ones. And leaving this in the hands of, profit-making private corporations is really not a solution. A lot of people on the left are satisfied with that because, the people that own these corporations are basically aligned with them in a lot of, cultural and policy issues. But I think if you want a durable liberal society, you've got to have rules that apply no matter who owns these platforms. You see this already with Elon Musk. I mean, a lot of conservatives are now happy. I guess he's just announced that he's going to let Donald Trump back on, back on Twitter. I'm not delighted that he's going to be back on, but I do think that it isn't really up to a private company to make such a momentous decision about, our political discourse. And therefore, we need a different approach to content moderation that, is a little bit more politically neutral.
So speaking then of, so we were focusing on the left critics of liberalism. What is the right critique of liberalism?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I actually just had a debate with Patrick Deneen in Michigan last week. So if you just take him as an exemplar of it, I think that the problem that many conservatives have, and particularly religious conservatives, is that liberalism deliberately, in a way, took the higher ends of man out of politics. It's a doctrine that began after Europe's wars of religion in the 17th century. And what liberals said is, we're going to agree to disagree about the most important things as defined by religion in the interests of surviving. So instead of the good life, we're going to aim at just life itself. And as a result, in a liberal society, people pursue whatever aims they want. They're not all on the same page. And particularly with regard to, moral or cultural matters, oftentimes they disagree. And I think that you know, what's probably bothered conservatives the most has to do with issues related to family, gender, you know, sexuality, and so forth, where you had a pretty, you know, clear rules established for social behavior, but those have gradually been eroded. And I think what they would like to see is a return to, you know, greater consensus. And, you know, what's interesting about Dineen is he, when he wrote his book Against Liberalism, his solution was basically just to retreat into the Benedict option, you know, to just practice your religious beliefs in private, in small groups and communities, which, by the way, I think is actually what a liberal society permits you to do. But he's now moved to a much more muscular position of, you know, wanting to get the power of the state behind this, you know, this single moral consensus, or as he put it, you know, a teleological understanding of human ends. And I think that that's actually pretty dangerous, because I don't think we agree on, you know, what the common good is and what the teleological end of man is. I think a lot of Americans would say there is no teleological.
What does teleological mean? You define
it. It, you know, it really comes out of Aristotelian ethics, the idea that there is a human nature that, you know, over time tends towards a certain understanding of the good. In, you know, in the hands of Catholic theologians like Aquinas, it really had to do with, you know, a religious understanding of the ends of man and serving God and so forth. And, you know, that's a very distinct view of, you know, human purposes. And I would say the reason that, you know, liberalism appeared originally is that Protestants and Catholics couldn't agree on that teleology, and ended up spending 150 years, you know, slaughtering each other. So I think, you know, a lot, I wouldn't say that most religious conservatives actually want this kind of muscular, you know, state-supported religious establishment, especially not in the United States. But, you know, there is this longing for a period, which I think is a kind of nostalgic misreading of past history, where everybody was Christian or everybody shared the same kind of religious, you know, worldview, and therefore there was more consensus on, you know, on these sensitive issues regarding family, sexuality, and so forth.
We're going to pivot to democracy, but you said a word that I want to focus in on for a second, especially given your background as a person who studied institutions. You said the word consensus, and when you were talking about social media platforms and content moderation and what they look like, the public square debate, my argument against folks who seek to implement some vision of that comes down to the fact that there isn't actually a consensus in American society around what those platforms should look like. So you couldn't actually get to a consensus right now in terms of, we think that here is the bar that Donald Trump could cross or could not cross as president for getting kicked off Twitter. This is what the public square looks like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is borne out in polling. But consensus is something that we should want. It's what enables liberal societies to function. How does a society get to a consensus on contentious issues? Is it merely a matter of one side winning? Is there a moderation? How does that tend to work, you think?
Well, first of all, there are things where there is a general consensus, you know, so all of the platforms don't permit, you know, explicit forms of violence to be shown, or, you know, really gross, you know, content, you know, that most people would, you know, in fact, I mean, if they didn't do that kind of content moderation, nobody would let their children watch, you know, watch the internet. No explicit pornography, you know, on Facebook or Google or, you know, this sort of thing. So there is consensus on a certain range of issues, but there, you're absolutely right that on a political question like should Donald Trump be allowed on Twitter, there isn't consensus. And, you know, what our working group decided in the end was that, you know, the basic principle, liberal principle of freedom of speech meant that actually you had to preserve that diversity of viewpoints because that's critical to a liberal society. You don't want everybody to agree on everything. You want consensus around the basic rules of the game that people should, you know, be allowed to express their views, but you're certainly not going to demand that everybody believe the same thing. That's not the point of a liberal society, and that's not the point of rules about freedom of speech. The problem that the platforms pose is not that they give a voice to opinions you don't like. The problem is their ability to amplify. So they can take a particular point of view and, you know, spread it around the country in, you know, a nanosecond, in a way that, you know, legacy media was really unable to do. And it's that amplification capability that you, you know, that you really need to worry about. But the objective of policy should not be to stamp out hate speech or conspiracy theories or Donald Trump or anybody else, because, you know, we have a First Amendment in this country and we do believe in viewpoint diversity. And so we want to preserve that. We simply want to make sure that no particular organization, whether it's the government or whether it's a large internet platform, you know, has this power to amplify or to shut down, you know, certain voices in the political dialogue.
This gets to the dynamic you're describing is interesting to me because, you know, in a piece that you wrote, I forget the name, right after the invasion of Ukraine started and when things started to go well for the Ukrainian forces, you spoke about increasing cynicism around democracy. You spoke of how the successful repelling of the invasion could actually serve to get us out of a funk. And when you're describing diverse voices, a lack of consensus, but that necessarily being a good thing because you don't want to just have someone stamping everyone to hold the same viewpoint, I agree to all of those points. But that basically describes the United States right now. There are all these sets of issues of all these different diverse sets of viewpoints. Yet people, especially younger people, I'm sure you encountered this in your students to the example you gave about the post-financial crisis era, feel cynical about democracy's ability to actually implement or actually do anything. So can you just talk about the dynamic there between, I think we want in the abstract, the diversity and a lack of, you know, forcing views, but there's also this draw to have folks say, no, but we want something to happen.
Yeah, so the problem right now is a complicated one. Liberal societies in general, as I said, are slow to act because they're very procedural. They want to be fair to people. They want to, you know, allow time for debate and discussion. And then, you know, interest groups begin pushing for things that they want. And, you know, there has to be a political system that takes all those inputs and gradually moves to consensus. So that's just given in any liberal society. The problem in America right now is that overlaid on top of that system is an extreme degree of cultural polarization and political polarization that makes, you know, the kind of bipartisan deal making that had characterized Congress and the American system through much of the 20th century, you know, really difficult. And so, you know, one of the most basic functions of any government is to pass a yearly budget, hopefully a responsible budget. But, you know, Congress has been repeatedly unable to do that and gone into shutdowns and, you know, these very bitter debates where you couldn't get a budget out and certainly not under regular order because the body was so polarized. And there's a whole bunch of policy issues right now that, you know, basically can't be solved because of that polarization. You know, immigration, I think there's actually a fair degree of consensus in the public in general as to what a sensible immigration policy would look like. But, you know, that polarization in Congress prevents anything from happening on that front. And so it's not just people on the left. It's, you know, a lot of people are very cynical about the system since it has been gridlocked in this fashion. And so that's, you know, both a consequence of the checks and balances inherent in a liberal order, but laid on top of a highly polarized underlying society means that, you know, nothing does happen. And I think that's really, that's been our problem for, you know, for some time now.
And that's why I want to go back to your claim, which I agree with at an intuitive level. I'm just interested in the order of operations here, that the successful repelling of the invasion of Ukraine could actually help us get out of the funk. Because when I the funk of cynicism and like a lack of faith in democracy, you know, I'm sure you see the Pew polls that come out every other year saying that young people no longer care about democracy, insert all those different statements there. Because when I look at what happened in Ukraine and what's happening in Ukraine, I'm obviously jazzed about it, to be super colloquial. But if I think to my peers, they don't see a tie between what's happening on the battlefield near Kyiv and the, like you said, interest group capture, the lack of ability to deal with cultural and political polarization. Help explain the tie, or maybe there isn't a tie.
Well, no, there's no direct tie of that sort. I think the tie is the following, that you have a lot of populist politicians around the world that really have been very sympathetic to Putin. So that includes, Marine Le Pen in France, or Eric Zemmour, the extreme right-wing candidate. That includes Viktor Orban in Hungary. And it also includes Donald Trump, who, as far as I can see, has not managed to say a single critical word about Putin or the Russian invasion or anything connected, to what's happened.
He did say genocide. That seemed kind of random, but
I remember this interview that he had with Hannity, where Hannity gave him like four times. He said, he basically gave him the opportunity to be critical of Putin, and he simply refused to do it every single time. So there's something going on, and I think it is related to his own instincts. When Putin recognized these republics, these so-called republics in the Donbass, Trump's immediate reaction was, that was brilliant. He just went and did it. I wish I could do something like that, on our southern border. And I think it's indicative of the instincts of a lot of populists, which is that they really don't like liberalism. What they don't like about it is the fact that it constrains them. They say to themselves, I was elected, I'm the voice of the people, I'm carrying out the people's will, and here's this judge that's telling me that I can't do something that I want to do, or, here's Congress that won't appropriate the money for my border wall, or, something of that sort. And the reason they admire Putin is that he doesn't have to worry about these kinds of checks and balances. And so I think that if the defeat of Putin also ends up discrediting all of the people that seem to like him, I think that's going to make our, politics better, because I think the, right now the clear and present danger to American democracy is coming from, that extreme right. Now, there is also a left, a progressive left, that poses, I think, a longer term cultural threat, because they're also intolerant in many important ways, and they're very big in a lot of cultural institutions. But I do think that the immediate threat really is coming from the extreme right in the United States, and therefore you defeat their patron saint, and it's going to reflect on on them.
Could you, and I'm sure you're, I'm sure I'm channeling your students when I say this, could you speak to what you see as the long, because I agree with you about the long-term cultural threat of the left, but I think the immediate audience advocate in me thinks, what are you talking about? It's the right that wants to possibly do an IUD plan, ban, repeal Roe v. Wade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, what would you identify the long-term cultural threat as relative to the current stakes?
It really has to do with a kind of intolerance of, other than progressive views in certain cultural settings. I don't like to use all these terms that we've been using about wokeness and cancel culture and so forth. But, living in a university as I do, it's clearly there that this is not the use of state power to silence voices. It's the use of social pressure make it very difficult to have serious conversations about a lot of issues. It is limited because it really focuses on, these questions having to do with civil rights, and particularly, you know, issues related to race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and so forth. But having kind of frank discussions about that is really difficult in, you know, in many cultural spaces, not because of the government, but because of the, you know, the pressure from other people. And I think social media really makes this problem worse because, you know, it's very, very easy for people to pile on to an expression of something that they don't like, but they don't have to spend much time actually engaging with the point of view, or, you know, they simply have to hit the like button or the dislike button. And, you know, they think they've made a contribution to discourse, whereas actually they've probably just exercised, you know, something more like mob rule.
I want to get back to the discussion of populism then, because I 100% understand and actually agree with your point around the weird, it's not weird because it makes sense at an ideological level, but the international populist politician sympathy towards Putin. I'm curious about how you think of the role of populism in Western, specifically American domestic politics, because, you know, the New York Times did a great profile of you and your book, and it basically talked about how what you really see is critics of liberalism have identified these overreaches by the left and the right. And the question is, without populism, how does one check that overreach? So without, let's say, William Jennings Bryan, without even Trump in 2016 bringing the China issue to the forefront, how can we reform liberalism without? Maybe you're not proposing to not have populism, but how does one go about reforming the system without that instinct?
Well, you know, it seems to me the normal democratic process gives you an avenue for reforming the system in a more serious way without blowing this whole system up. I mean, that's my real objection to Trump and Trumpism, is that they're not actually proposing serious ways of reforming what's wrong with the system. They're doing things that will basically, you know, undermine the system in the hopes that something will emerge down the road that is more to their liking. Let me give you just a really concrete example of this. So at the end of the Trump administration, they issued something called Schedule F, which basically would have put all existing federal civil servants on at-will hiring and firing. And I think what was driving this in Trump's mind was he didn't like Anthony Fauci, but he couldn't fire Fauci because he's protected by, you know, civil service system. And a lot of Republican governors, you know, at a state level have been pushing for this kind of discretionary ability to hire and fire. Now, there is a reasonable version of that, which is, you know, basically that public sector unions have made it extremely difficult for managers in the public sector to discipline incompetent or poorly performing workers. This is a big issue, you know, with a lot of teachers' unions around the country and so forth, that you can't improve school performance because you can't get rid of anybody, right? So there's a reasonable version of this. But, you know, the unreasonable version is the one that was just articulated by J.D. Vance, where he said, you know, if we come to power, we're going to basically fire all civil servants. And when they say, you know, you can't, when a judge says you can't do that, we're going to say, you know, you try to stop us the way he claims Andrew Jackson did back in, you know, 1828. And, you know, this is basically destroying the system. I mean, do you really want to get rid of merit requirements for people that work at NASA or at the CDC or, you know, any number, you know, at NOAA in the, you know, forecasting of the weather, and replace these all with basically political hacks that are loyal to you, you know, which was really the personnel policy of the Trump administration? I don't think so. You know, so there's a sensible way to reform the system that I, you know, fully admit needs reforming. There's a lot of parts of the bureaucracy that are not accountable, that go off on, you know, tangents that really don't correspond to democratic will, but there's better and worse ways of dealing with that. And, you know, I think the instinct of people like Trump is just destroy everything And, you know, we hope that something good will come out of the ashes of that. And I just don't think that's the way to fix things. And so what you'd want is democratic will to do these reforms, but to do them in a way that will seriously address the real problems and not, you know, imaginary ones.
And okay, Beth, I'm glad you set it up that way. What would you say the imaginary problems of American society are? And what are then the real problems in your view?
Well, look, it gets back to a lot of basic things that are thrown around in politics, like the administrative state, or the deep state. This was a phrase that was popularized by Steve Bannon and then taken up by Trump himself. And, there's a kind of imaginary world that they see where you could get rid of all of the experts and qualified people in government and replace them with basically politically aligned people that would make America work better. And we actually had that system. You know, it actually was Andrew Jackson that did this back in the 1820s, where he essentially politicized the entire, you know, civil service at that time. Everybody was a political appointee. The levels of corruption in American politics were just enormous at that point. Everybody was a patronage, a payoff. They got their jobs as a result of patronage and political payoffs. And so we've seen that kind of system before. And I think that these people on the right that criticize the modern administrative state are kind of imagining that somehow the 19th century was this paradise of true democracy where the people really ruled. Well, they did rule in the sense that they elected politicians that then gave them jobs, whether they were qualified or not. So I think that's, you know, genuinely imaginary, or, you know, it reflects a lack of awareness of American history and some of the problems of going down the path that they're advocating.
It's interesting because, you know, JD has been on the podcast, so I'll channel him for a second. JD feels very clearly that, and I think if you pushed him the way you just articulated it, he would say, look, like, I obviously don't think the 19th century was a paradise. He's well read. He knows the whole civil service reform era from 1870 to 1890 something basically was there for a reason. He would say, though, the costs of meritocracy, sorry, the benefits of meritocracy are not worth their costs, because he sees the issues we're facing as very existential. What, and this is a left and a right issue. Like, this seems to be one of the drivers of polarization. Things feel existential. What do you say to, and it seems to me that you can't have a political system where both sides see compromise, advancement, slow plotting, but not radical reform. They see that thing as existential danger. So what do you say to that version of the argument?
Well, I think it's ridiculous. It's not, I mean, we're not facing in either direction. And well, let me modify that. If as a result of the manipulation of the electoral count system in 2024, you manage to elect a president in spite of, you know, popular will, yeah, that will be existential for American democracy. But short of that, you know, I think this whole rhetoric about existential threats to our way of life is really what's propelling the polarization. It's grossly exaggerated. I mean, just again, to give you an example from my debate with Patrick last week, you know, he kept complaining about tyranny in the United States. And I said, well, Patrick, explain to me exactly where the government has been acting in a tyrannical fashion that really threatens your way of life. And thought about it for a while. He came up with an example of some nuns that were being forced to sell contraceptives or offer contraceptive services. And, you know, okay, so maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's a bit of bureaucratic overreach. But, you know, we got an example of real tyranny, right? As we speak, the Russians are forcibly removing, you know, it looks like tens of thousands of citizens of Ukraine and sending them to camps somewhere in Russia where they're just going to disappear for the rest of their lives. You know, so that's real tyranny. I don't think that anything that we're experiencing in the United States, you know, comes remotely close to that. Or another example, in one of these school board protests, you know, the protesters showed up wearing Stars of David on their coats. because they didn't like, I don't know, it was a mask mandate or a vaccine mandate or something like that. And again, you know, I just think that that shows, you know, so the Jews in Europe were facing a true existential threat.
I know what you're talking about. So they wore the yellow star as if they was the hog. I just want to make it clear for the listeners, because this is.
Right. And again, you know, being under a mandate to get a vaccine is simply not like being a Jew in the Holocaust. It just isn't. You know, the latter was a existential threat to the people there. But, you know, what we're facing in the United States is a little bit of inconvenience, and maybe you don't like the policy so much, but, you know, you can live with it. And so I just think the existential rhetoric on both sides is not helpful. It greatly exaggerates the kinds of harms that we are potentially facing. And it feeds, you know, the polarization, because if you believe something is existential, you're going to take extreme actions that will then, you know, become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because, you know, it's going to trigger extreme actions on the other side. And I think you're sort of seeing that with the kind of potential escalation in actual violence, you know, coming out of the George Floyd protests and then people arming themselves to counter the protesters and so forth. That is not a healthy way for a democracy, you know, to exist.
Okay, so this is, I want to make this explicit then, because I'm sure an audience member is going to be kind of confused by this. At the start of the episode, you critique, and once again, for everyone listening, I am pro-vaccine mandate. It's my bias. I am pro-lockdown up until some period in, you know, 2021. But you critiqued China's lockdown policy today. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between our liberal society version of vaccine lockdowns, of COVID lockdowns, and the authoritarian Chinese version?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's simple. You know, we were doing these lockdowns early on in the crisis before anybody understood the way that COVID spread, right? We thought that you get it from touching surfaces, and so everybody was using hand sanitizer. And turns out that wasn't that important. But most importantly, it was before there were vaccines. And so, you know, lockdowns were really the only way that you could at that point control the spread. But once, you know, the bulk of the population got vaccinated, and as the virus kept mutating into less and less deadly forms, the lockdown just made a lot, you know, it just didn't make sense anymore. And so it was perfectly reasonable that we would accept a greater degree of risk by opening things up, because the economic costs of the lockdown are very great. The Chinese, by contrast, are at this late stage. They haven't vaccinated people fully because they don't have effective vaccines. They're not willing to use the imported, better quality Western vaccines. But even so, the economic cost of locking down a city of 27 million people is enormous for very, very little benefit, because, you know, Omicron just isn't that deadly. So it makes no sense for them to do it at this point. And I think it would make no sense for, you know, an American city to go into a lockdown, because, you know, like, well, just at Stanford in the past week, we've gone from like 18 to 380 COVID cases. So half of my students have to quarantine because of this. I'm not sure that that's such a sensible policy, because at this point, COVID has become, it genuinely is more like the flu. When conservatives said it's just the flu back in March of 2020, they were wrong about that. You know, it was much more deadly because of the lack of vaccinations. But today, you know, that's actually a reasonable position to take. So that's what I think the difference is.
No, and once again, the key difference is we can easily get on this podcast recording and talk about whether we disagree with the COVID policy or not. There's a very meta level conversation that I think is important to note there for listeners. So for this last section, I want to focus on my favorite line in the essay you wrote, or more like the blog post you wrote towards the start of the invasion, where you referred to this invasion as providing an opportunity to revive the spirit of 1989. I was born in 1992, so obviously I wasn't there for the events described, but can you, from your perspective, like, what was the spirit of 1989?
Well, it was quite remarkable. I was working in the State Department that year, and everybody had assumed that European politics was frozen because we had experienced a Cold War that had really begun in the late 1940s. And, you know, we all assumed that the Soviet Union would be there forever, that Europe would be divided forever, that Germany would be divided. And then beginning in the spring of 1989, you had a refugee crisis where people were fleeing East Germany. And then you had these miraculous transformations in Poland and Hungary, where, you know, people seem to be actually rejecting communism in favor of some kind of democracy. And then the thing snowballed in the coming months. I remember in late October, I was at a NATO planners meeting, and I brought up the question of German unification, and the German representative said, "That'll never happen in my lifetime." And then, you know, roughly 2 weeks later, the Berlin Wall comes down and Germany actually unifies. And so there was this just unbelievable sense of disbelief that things could actually be this good. You know, this many people were being freed of this oppressive political system, really without a shot being fired in most cases. And, you know, it gave people a lot of hope that, you know, the idea of democracy was something that would be contagious. And in fact, it was. I mean, it spread to other parts of the world that, you know, didn't have the same conditions as communist Eastern Europe, but, you know, it inspired people to behave in similar sorts of ways. So that was the spirit of 1989. Clearly, you know, we're kind of in the opposite direction at the moment. It's a spreading spirit of authoritarianism, where you have a coup in one country that then stimulates, you know, some soldier in another country to launch a coup there. And, you know, that's a unfortunate momentum that I think needs to be broken.
The key takeaway I took from this book and, you know, various reviews is this idea of needing to, once again, to quote the Times, like, you know, moderate liberalism. And when you talk about the spirit of 89, and once again, when you're talking about moderating liberalism, you're speaking both domestically. So if you explicitly refer to neoliberal market economics, transcending just the obvious fact that the market oriented economy is most likely the most logical form and fashion to organize society, to treating this as an almost religious invocation, which you could then see manifested in the 2008 financial crisis. Right. And then you obviously have the Iraq war, which you came out very aggressively opposing with deep dissatisfaction, really separating from a lot of colleagues ideologically on that. Both cases, domestic economics, mm-hmm. foreign policy, overreach. Mm-hmm. How does one imbue this spirit of 89? Which I think most people can agree with, without leading to overreach, let's say 10, 15 years from now?
Well, you know, I think it just takes wisdom and statesmanship and, you know, good political leadership to not, you know, Stalin had this phrase, dizzy with success. And I think, you know, being dizzy with success is a temptation. And that, you know, really did happen, I think, in the 1990s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, liberals got overconfident. They said, you know, we're going to get rid of every last remaining dictatorship in the world, keeping up the momentum from that period. And the free market type said, yes, we're going to tear down, you know, these walls of regulation wherever we see them. And that led to the, you know, financial deregulation that was really the cause of the 2008 crisis. So how would you have prevented that? Well, I think you would have needed people to keep their heads a little bit better. But, you know, it's not an obvious thing to do when you're in a period where you do have this kind of general feeling that things are going your way. But, you know, I think prudent leaders understand that there are limits to the powers that they have, and they behave accordingly. I'm afraid I can't give a more you know,
this is the ultimate political question. So if you had, you would have written a different book if you had that clear answer. So for the final question here, then, I do like your framework of wisdom, statesmanship, leadership. I'd say a big theme of this episode has been, like, how does one reform systems, structures that have various structural and just sort of individual problems facing them. I'm curious, you know, you as another funny line from the New York Times piece was the fact that your two-volume series on institutions covered 50,000 years of history. You quote may have overdone it on the research side. What is a moment or an era or just an example you could give listeners that should give them that should convince them that the answer isn't burning down the system and starting over, isn't saying, okay, let's just throw things to Bernie, let's throw things to Trump, and I'll throw those are the same thing at a moral level. But is there an example that comes to mind when you think from a maybe what's helped people be optimistic perspective?
I think it helps to think back to other liberal societies and their successes and what made them successful. I think, very often about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was a liberal empire that produced the fin de siècle Vienna that, you know, was the home of Gustav Mahler and Sigmund Freud and Hugo von Hofmannsthal. On the Hungarian wing of the empire, you had, you know, Edward Teller and Leo Szilard and John von Neumann, you know, these monumentally great physicists, all of them Jews. You think about that society and the fact that the freedom that people enjoyed, you know, produced this kind of towering cultural achievement and scientific achievement. And then the whole thing gets shut down by the rise of Hitler, you know, this fascist mayor, Karl Luger in Vienna, mark this shift towards a much more restrictive, nationalistic, illiberal understanding of both German and Austrian politics, and you know, produced you know the war that then really wrecked European civilization. So I think it's helpful to remember the good things and the incredible creativity that you know true liberal diversity actually promotes. Just to dot some I's and cross some T's, you know, Viktor Orban today says Hungarian national identity is built around Hungarian ethnicity. All of those physicists I mentioned that came out of a single gymnasium in Budapest were all Jews. And therefore, by Viktor Orban's definition, they're not Hungarian. They're outside of the national community that he wants to create. And I think that that kind of shows you what the problems with this kind of nationalist populism are, that, you know, the diversity that you get in a liberal society actually is the grounds for incredible creativity and human excellence. And I think, you know, that in itself should inspire people to, you know, want to create that kind of a society as well in the present.
Well said. Francis Fukuyama, thank you for joining us on The Realignment and congratulations on the book launch.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.